This is Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy, the arts of attracting, acquiring, and retaining talent. Here's Kathleen.
Welcome back to my conversation with Professor Allison Gabriel from the University of Arizona's Eller College of Management. We've been talking about her research on employee well-being, along with her own well-being, as she's been sharing the challenges of having a baby at the start of the pandemic and returning back to work. Allie, let's talk about attracting top talent. In part one, we discussed the effect the pandemic had on forcing people out of the workforce, especially women. So as you look at women who are the primary caregivers for their children, or maybe even a spouse or partner, what are you finding that really matters to these working moms?
Sure. So again, in this, the work we're doing right now, because it's been unfolding over the last year, so we're like peak COVID recovery or in COVID because the pandemic's still happening.
Right.
You know, the things that we're hearing really consistently across these different studies we're doing is that flexibility really matters, right? And again, that is allowing people to really craft what their days look like. I think, you know, that's not unique just to working mothers or working parents broadly. We're seeing that in a lot of discussion, you know, that Anthony Klotz was leading around the Great Resignation and, you know, why people are quitting and changing jobs. It's for that flexibility and finding structures that suit them. But another big piece, and this is coming up in some of our work on how we can be better allies to women as they return to work, is really making sure that we are doing things as employees, as coworkers, as managers, as leaders, to really welcome women back and really validate their worker identity, to not just see them as like, oh, you're a working mom now, right? Or, oh, you had a baby. And that's part of allyship too, is recognizing that, like, you are not the same person fundamentally as you were, you know, however long ago, the last time we saw you, the last time you were here in the office. That's a big part of it, and celebrating that and helping women become part of a kind of working parent community, seeing the baby pictures, doing all of that, that's all good and helpful. But it's really validating and make sure women feel seen in their employee role, that people were recognizing, like, hey, you're doing a really hard thing, and you're working, and you're crushing it, and we see you. Let's get you up to speed. Let's help you get back, so we're not just handing you a computer with an inbox full of emails from the last 3 months, right? Mm-hmm. Let's do things proactively to help you see the progress that you have made, or that we have made in your absence, and where you still fit into that. Because I think one of the biggest struggles, and this was something that I struggled with, and luckily this was my own thing, not anything that was happening to me, but I just constantly felt left behind, or that I was getting left behind, right? That people were moving on without me because the projects and the work that we were doing were still happening in my absence, because I had great co-authors and collaborators who helped create boundaries for me. But I still felt really scared that I was going to be left behind. And that feeling lasted for about a year. And we're seeing that come out in our research of women saying, you know, one of the best things that can be done is managers, employees, coworkers talking to me and validating that my role still matters, that I was not left behind. And here are the ways that I can get plugged back in so I don't feel that, right? So I don't feel like, oh gosh, I have 4 or 5 months to catch up on. No, I'm just getting plugged back in and supported. So the flexibility and then really validating that worker identity are really, really important to help women reconnect and come back into the workforce. You know, because some of these bigger issues like childcare, right? Affordable childcare, you know, it's rare that every single organization is going to be able to solve that. So what can we do? Well, we can improve at a minimum kind of the psychological experience and toll of work, so women feel like they are supported and not burdens or people who got forgotten about. I think that's a really, really big part of the puzzle right now.
Yeah. Interesting. So there are some women that, you know, leave the workforce for that 12-week period, or, you know, maybe they're lucky enough and they get to have a little bit longer period of time. But what about those working women who have taken 6 years off, 10 years off, so that they can be there to raise their children until they get into kindergarten or first grade? Is there any research that you've done or anything that you've tapped into that addresses, like, if there are recruiting processes that need to change or to adapt to that working mom who now decides to step away from their career, but then wants to come back, and that they are not penalized for that?
That's a great question. So that's not something that we've directly tackled in our research yet. I would say we're pretty focused right now on kind of the what I would call a classic return to work, which is, you know, the 6 to 12 weeks for women. Hopefully it's at least 12, but we see a lot of women coming back much sooner than that for financial reasons. But there has been some research that I am familiar with where there have been discussions about, you know, how do we frame that gap on the resume, right? What does that mean? And there isn't a lot of consensus quite yet, but you've started to see some really interesting things of some people just leaning directly in and saying, this is where I was and this is why, you know, I'm on mm-hmm. leave and let's talk about that. There's been some discussion about leaving those to not list years that you've been with the company, like the actual calendar years, but instead to say, you know, I worked, I don't know, in PR in this company in this role for 7 years. Then I worked in this role for X years. And just listing kind of the company and the name and the experience versus the actual calendar year to highlight that, hey, there's this gap, right, of, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. But I, again, as we are going to see a number of women have left the workforce as a function of COVID and the division of, you know, childcare labor, I think these solutions and these challenges are going to keep coming up. And so I personally am really eager to see this kind of research that I know is starting to circulate of how do we frame these gaps and how do we start looking at that as, you know, a limitation versus a strength, right? That this person knows how to prioritize, right? Isn't mm-hmm. that a valuable skill that this person knew to take a step back, prioritize something that really matters to them, and now they're coming back because they're ready for the next thing they want to prioritize. Let's talk about that versus just how many years were you here and why do you have this gap on your resume? So no work we're directly doing, but I know these ideas are starting to circulate out there and I'm really eager to see them start to come out to our journals and then eventually in the popular press.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting because they certainly, they're the ones that are organizing things at the, you know, in the schools or, and so they bring right. just so much experience and skill sets to the working world. All right. So I really want to talk about the Future of Work conference that you were, that you spoke at recently, specifically on combating fatigue as it relates to virtual meetings. So let's talk about this whole thing that's been completely made up called Zoom fatigue. No one ever feels that, right? And you conducted a 4-week experiment that looked at the role of cameras on employee fatigue and explored whether these feelings are worse for certain employees or versus others. So tell us what you found.
Sure. Right off again, I want to say that so this work was led by Kristen Shockley, who's just a brilliant organizational psychologist. She's on faculty at University of Georgia. And her counterpart on this was Darren Robertson, who's actually right here in Tucson at BroadPath Health. And it's a company that really specializes in, you know, remote workforces and their workforce is remote. And again, this was actually all happening during my transition to work. So Kristen and Darren were working on this idea of studying Zoom fatigue and manipulating camera use. And as the project progressed and data was coming in, Kristen reached out and was like, you know, I know you've sworn off doing COVID research, which at the time I had. Now it's kind of a joke because I've done a bunch of COVID projects because you can't study well-being and not end up studying COVID and its effects mm-hmm. on well-being. She approached me and said, do you have any interest? And it just sounded so fascinating that they had, you know, developed a way to conduct this real-time field experiment. So they took BroadPath employees and divided them into two groups. So one group for 2 weeks was encouraged to use their cameras as much as possible during all of their meetings. And the other group was instructed to keep them off. And then at the halfway point, the group switched. And as that experiment was going on, they were also getting these short daily surveys at the end of each workday asking about their fatigue and their level of engagement in meetings and the extent to which they felt like they had a voice and could speak up in those meetings. And when I started analyzing the data, I remember going to Kristen and being like, wow, these effects are just whopping, right? So being on camera significantly related to feelings of daily fatigue. And what was really fascinating to me, because, you know, as I was starting to, I like to break my data as much as possible to figure out, you know, is it something else? Is it something else? Is it something else? So I was like, well, is it the camera or is it just the number of meetings they had or the amount of time they spent in these virtual meetings? And And we had all that data. We had employees' Outlook calendars, so we could look at, you know, at least what they had scheduled for that day for themselves. And those two variables had no bearing on the daily feelings of fatigue. It was the camera. And what was then really interesting was that those feelings of fatigue hindered employees' engagement in the meetings and their self-reported feelings of voice in those meetings. So the irony was quickly not lost on us that the very thing that cameras are supposed to promote, which is being more engaged and feeling like you can speak up, was inadvertently getting hit because employees were so fatigued from being on camera. And we found that this was a stronger effect for women and for newcomers. And that makes a lot of sense when you think about, you know, a lot of what we've talked about of women during the pandemic, that they were more likely to, you know, also have childcare demands. So they're more likely to be interrupted by their kids on camera, which can, you know, violate professionalism norms that we might have in the workplace, depending on your organization. There are just higher self-presentation costs, right, of being on camera and what you have to physically kind of present yourself as. And for newcomers, right, your entry into an organization is just so overwhelming with the jargon and the politics and the acronyms and everything else, the norms that you need to learn, that being on camera for those two groups, the effects got worse. They were stronger. And so that project really kind of took a life of its own, thanks to Adam Grant, who's at Wharton, who helped organize led the Future Work Conference and invited me to be a part of it, because he tweeted about our study, and it just took off like we could have never anticipated. And it's not that I think the solution here is to never be on camera, because I think that's unrealistic. But again, it really dovetails nicely with a lot of what we've talked about today, which is flexibility and restoring autonomy back to employees of, you know what, maybe we don't have to mandate people are on camera all the time, or maybe we can co-create norms at the start of our meetings for who wants to be on camera, who wants to be off, what is this going to look like, or maybe, just maybe, we don't have to be on Zoom for all of our meetings, or we could just go back to having phone calls. And, you know, I personally miss having phone calls, because I would always go for walks when I would be on them, and just get some nice time and a break in my day where I could multitask my recovery and my work. But yeah, that study, it's just been so interesting just hearing from so many people. It's like, oh my gosh, I thought it was just me. Like, I'm used to having meetings. I had meetings before COVID. This isn't new, but gosh, like feeling on camera feels, being on camera just feels awful. And why? And it's a lot of this just self-presentation-ness, right, of seeing yourself on camera, of having a harder time reading social cues, of not knowing who's paying attention to what. It's just, there's a lot more confusing dynamics. And there have been other research teams, you know, one led actually by my former doctoral student, Andrew Bennett, who's now on faculty at Old Dominion, where, yeah, just being on camera seems to have this really strong effect on people.
In the research, did it matter, you know, was it looked at the size of the meeting?
That's a great question. So it was something that had come up, and we unfortunately didn't have any data on that. But I think that's a nice way to start to extend our work, is to start to understand, you know, how can we build better meetings, right? Like, what is the structure, or is it a threshold that after a certain number of people, we don't really need cameras, or if it's only this many people, we really should all be on camera, right? It would be probably feel a little weird if it was just two people and one had their camera on and one had their camera off, and it's just going to be a strange interpersonal dynamic. But, you know, yeah, what are the characteristics of the meeting, or even the gender composition of the meeting, and how is that all going to factor in? I think those are all really, really good questions for future work to kind of continue moving this Zoom fatigue discussion forward, given that even though a number of employees are returning to work, hybrid remote options for a lot of companies are here to stay. So that means Zoom is here to stay. So we better solve it, because this wasn't just some, you know, 30-day experiment. We're now over 2 years of going through this.
Right, right. I was part of a discussion on LinkedIn, and I would say there might have been 35 people on this call, and easily 30 of them had their cameras off. And it was the hardest thing, because I couldn't, you know, like, nobody was participating, and it was a discussion on, you know, and I just thought, oh my gosh, so there's the five people that were on camera were, you know, I think they were feeling very sorry for me also. But I do think you raise an interesting point, because I know for us at our meetings, we do have the co-created norms, and one of them is that, you know, video on, electronics off. Now, mm-hmm. you know, we have our leadership meeting, that's 12 or 13 people, so that would be expected. But when we have our monthly company calls, you know, we can get 50 people onto a screen now. But I can see where moving back to, because we were doing, and again, what's crazy about right. this is we've been virtual the whole time, and we've always used telephone. We never used video. And then right. now the pandemic, and we all went to video. So I think probably a lot of us would like to go back to telephones, and we can have one-on-ones and you know, walk around the block at the same time.
Yeah, I actually, our faculty here is growing by one person, Katina Sawyer, who's a lovely organizational psychologist, so sharp and brilliant, and we're lucky to have her. But I remember when she was kind of deciding what she was going to do, I was like, well, she was like, do you have time to chat? And I was like, oh, sure. And I just called her. And I remember she was like, oh, like she answered, she's like, oh, phone call. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. We used to do this. Like, we used to just call people and not be like, oh, I'll send you my Zoom link, right? Like, we've like reverted or changed what it means to just have a call with somebody where we think it has to be Zoom. But no, yeah. I think we can reimagine a lot of work. And I hope that's a part of it.
Yeah. Well, I think yesterday I was in a meeting all morning. Then I came home and had Zoom meetings, and you know, I'm like, I was so tired last night. I almost didn't make it through the whole Phoenix Suns basketball game. But so it's, I think we're going to have a different level of fatigue, but we'll just have to keep eating our Wheaties and taking our vitamin B, right?
Yes. And sleeping.
Yes. Very, very important. Very important. Well, you know, Allie, one of the things that I've really enjoyed is how you have shared a lot of your personal challenges and your work-life balance and wellness through social media. And so for women that are contemplating when's the right time to start a family, what's your advice?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's funny you ask that, because when... It makes me laugh now. So when we got pregnant with Eleanor, so that would have been June 2019, I remember kind of brazenly declaring, like, there's no right time to have a baby, but we found the right time. Like, I was through the 10-year process, again, in a really supportive department here, so there was a clear kind of path for me forward, hopefully, to move through to the next promotion. My parents had just moved to Tucson. We felt really secure. And the next day, a pandemic got declared. So I'm never going to say that there's a right time to have a baby ever again. Because I was like, oh, that's what I get for saying that we picked the perfect time to do this. So I guess that is my message, that there is no perfect time. In many ways, we're happy we had her when we did, but we're also sad because Eleanor is awesome. And, you know, we're on the older side of having kids. You know, I think they start saying, like, you're a geriatric pregnancy when you hit 35, and I had her right when I turned 35. It's the worst label I have ever heard.
Yeah, so let's get rid of that one right away.
Yeah, let's stop that, please. And so we always kind of say, like, man, it would have been so nice to have known her earlier, because she's just so lovely. And so I don't think there is a right time. I think instead it's finding the, and in reality, I think this is why we kind of decided when we did, it's finding the moment where you feel most supported and that you think mm-hmm. you have the structures that work for you. And because that really is what was lining up for us. I think even without the pandemic, you know, it's really hard to say. And I've thought about this a lot of, like, if it hadn't been for the pandemic and we could have had, you know, the community around us, because we were basically isolated, and we still right. are in a lot of ways from a lot of people since she's unvaccinated, but especially those first 6 months, we were so isolated from people. Mm-hmm. It was really lonely. You know, would I have had PPD still? And the answer is probably, because there would have been new challenges, right? Like, there would have been new struggles. Maybe it wouldn't have been as severe. So I think my biggest piece of advice is trying to think about what are the supports I need to live my life the way that I want to do it with a child. And whether that's, you know, recrafting your work schedule or your partner's work schedule, if you have the ability to do so, or trying to find childcare and supports that work for you, I think that is best, because I hope organizations keep pushing the margins with what it means to support women and their pregnancy, their conception, everything. But until we get there, I think it really is about finding coworkers who can support you, creating structures outside of work that can support you, and really leaning into that and just trusting that you will have that social safety net. And thank goodness that I had that as much as I did. But yeah, I look back at that. I'm like, oh gosh, how funny that I was like, this is the perfect time. And then as we were getting discharged from the hospital, the pediatrician that discharged us was like, you might want to listen to the news on the way home. Some stuff has gone down and you should go find toilet paper. And we're like, what are you talking about? Like, we're going home and people are bringing us dinner and we have family visiting in a couple of weeks. And he was like, no, you don't. And we're like, what? And now I'm like, oh gosh. So anyway, so that is my biggest piece of advice, because it is just, it is difficult no matter what. It is, I think, in many ways worth it no matter what. And I'm so thankful for Eleanor. Terrible toddler twos or whatever we'd call it and all. She is just a delight and a joy. And I think it has made me recraft and rethink about my work as hard as this whole journey has been. So I'm very, very thankful for that.
Well, that's great. Well, you know, they do say it takes a village, and I can assure you it does.
Yes, absolutely.
And then as I tell everyone, just grab your popcorn, sit back to watch this movie unfold, because it's the best movie that you will ever be able to watch in your whole life.
Yes,
my kids are you know, adult children now, and we just have such a delightful time together. But it's been wonderful watching their journey, and now as they're moving into their adult careers, it's the story only gets better. So, well, Allie, I have so enjoyed our conversation today. You've taught me a lot. I'm sure you've taught our listeners a lot. So, what is the best way for people to connect with you and to keep abreast of the work that you're doing?
Sure. Well, again, thank you so much. This conversation has been so great and therapeutic for me. It's always helpful for me to kind of reflect and think about my life and my work in this way. So I'm so grateful you've given me the opportunity to do so. If you want to find me, my faculty page is really easy to access, but I have my own website. It's AllisonGabriel.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn under the same name. And then I'm on Twitter at ProfASGabriel. And you can see all sorts of pictures there. It's like a mix of research musings and food cravings and pictures of Eleanor doing really, really funny stuff. So if you're interested in that kind of mix of research, food, baby, travel, life, that's probably the Twitter account for you. If not, maybe don't follow. But that's where you can find me.
Like Mama on TV.
Yes. Yeah. That was the best for future work. She was just flabbergasted that I was standing there next to her. And then she was also seeing me up on, you know, the laptop, which she thinks is a TV. She's like, Mama on TV. And it was just absolutely, it was just the best. And I'm so glad that she gets to, that I have the support and the ability to let her see me in that way. So
That's great. Well, enjoy her, enjoy the twos, and it'll be a great year.
Oh, thank you so much. And again, thank you for fostering this conversation. It's so important. And I'll say it again, I'm just really, really grateful. So thank you.
You're welcome. She's Dr. Allison Gabriel, the McClellan Professor of Management and Organizations at the University of Arizona's Eller College of Management. And that's it for this episode of Revolutionizing Recruitment. I hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, make sure you take a second to subscribe so you automatically get my new shows when they drop. Also, if you have a minute, I'd love if you left us a review so more people like yourself can discover the show. Until next time, take care.
This has been Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy. To connect with Kathleen or to learn more about recruitment research, go to duffygroup.com.